On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about election hacks and anti-compete campaigns, and we bring in CTO of Path Solutions to talk network troubleshooting. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, episode 240, recorded May 19th, 2017. Don't turtle your network.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Drobo, a family of safe, expandable, yet simple-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit drobostore.com to learn more and use the code TWIT10 to save 10% off select Drobos, including the new Drobo 5N2. And literally by Sonic, TWIT's 10-gig fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/twit to sign up for service and receive your first month free.
Welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Maresca, and I'm your guide with all things in the enterprise, but I do not want to take you on this ride alone. I need help from some of the top enterprise tech professionals in the world and potentially my favorite person in the world, Mr. Brian Tree, the director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. And how are you, my friend?
I'm doing good. I've been hiding out in a data center, racking and stacking, and finding out that the guys that shipped me a whole bunch of gear from Maui left all the fiber optics uncapped. They actually took all the fiber optic cables and just threw it in a box. So I've been cleaning and inspecting and cleaning and inspecting, and it's amazing just sitting in a box how much crud accumulates on fiber optics. I even had glass chips in there because some idiot was pounding away at the fiber or something. It's horrible.
Yeah, just make sure you don't inhale any of that canned air. You never know what's in that stuff. So, but well, folks, we have quite a show today. We have an amazing guest, Tim Titus from the CTO of Path Solutions, who's going to talk to a little bit about methodologies and how to troubleshoot your network. But also we talk about political hacks from in France, as well as some telecom anti-competitive movements. But before we do that, let's go ahead and jump into the blips. Well, WikiLeaks strikes again with another post from Vault 7 leak debuting CIA's Project Athena, I'm sorry. Like other malware or spyware systems from the CIA, Athena is a remote beacon and loader. Once installed by email attachment or other means of process invoke, the malware provides loading and unloading of malicious payloads, as well as sending and receiving of files and also beaconing capabilities. This particular piece of malware targets machines running Windows XP all the way up to Windows 10. So essentially, no one's safe in this one. Based on the leaky documents, it seems that this particular system was published just a month after Windows 10 was released. The interesting part of it is it's actually developed in Python. It's giving a little bit of Python, giving hackers a little bit of cred and Python a little cred from the CIA. The documents also describe a mandate that the spyware has a requirement to not be caught by antivirus software packages. It looks like the CIA wasn't the only one that had hand in developing the system. Siege Systems, or Siege Technologies, also contributed to the efforts. They are an American cybersecurity firm known for their cyber warfare technologies. Since March, WikiLeaks has published 9 other separate batches from Vault 7 series, debuting man-in-the-middle attacks, web beacons, malware, obfuscators, and pretty much just about anything else. Like WannaCry, let's hope this particular system's code and binaries are not released anytime soon.
Well, you know, this topic's just not going to go away anytime soon. And this time, our friends at Microsoft are yelling at the CIA to stop hoarding vulnerabilities. Actually, it's not just the CIA. It's all the spy agencies. So in the midst of ongoing WannaCry attacks, Microsoft has issued an unusually strong worded warning to governments around the world to quit hoarding vulnerabilities. The bug exploited by the attack was hoarded by the United States National Security Agency and leaked earlier this year and since patched by Microsoft. But patches aren't perfect. Rollouts take time, and WannaCrypt locked up a lot of machines in its first wave. Microsoft is not pleased, and in this post, renews its call for a digital Geneva Convention and its longstanding demand that governments disclose vulnerabilities to vendors instead of stockpiling them. And the bottom line is, if you have any SMB1 server, including NAS units, they need to be behind a firewall and patched immediately.
So we love to bring this one up. So I'm guessing all of you listening and watching, remember the broadband privacy protections taking a plunge back in March? Well, we also reported that some of the cities and states are taking it into their own hands to issue new legislation to bring those protections back. Well, the FCC is not too happy with this new process. FCC Commissioner Mike O'Reilly has been quoted saying he will find ways to take actions against the state from passing such protection law. Why? Well, the FCC feels that this would put a huge strain on the providers to have to alter their business for each state and potential city, causing a cascading effect of cost and lower service quality. The current charter for the FCC is, and I quote, restore free market principles to broadband offerings. Now, to offer the flip side of this, if the states could, in fact, enact laws that would favor ISPs and providers as well as at this point, because there's no legislation regulating either side of the coin, we hope that in the future they will pass some regulations and at least some guidelines.
Well, Google security researchers may have evidence that WannaCry is linked to North Korea. A researcher has found digital fingerprints that tie the WCry ransomware worm that menaced the world on a couple Fridays ago to a prolific hacking operation that previously generated headlines by attacking Sony Pictures, the Bangladesh Central Bank, and South Korean banks. The link came in a cryptic Twitter message from Neil Mehta, a security researcher at Google. The tweet referenced identical code found in a WCry sample from February and an earlier 2015 version of Cantopi, a malicious backdoor used by the Lazarus Group, a hacking team that has been operating since at least 2011. Previously discovered code fingerprints already tied Lazarus Group to the highly destructive hack that caused hard drives in South Korea to self-destruct in 2013, wiped almost a terabyte's worth of data from Sony Pictures in 2014, and siphoned almost $1 billion from Bangladesh Central Bank last year by compromising the SWIFT network used to transfer funds. These code snippets seem to link WCry to the Lazarus Group, and work done on the Sony hack seems to have linked Lazarus to North Korea. This break might be the thread that other security researchers can follow that could potentially lead to solidify evidence on who released the worm and possibly why.
So we kind of already knew that this was coming, but one of the large antivirus software companies today, Avast, warned this past week that home appliances that are connected to the internet are the next targets for hackers. How? Well, they'll target your vulnerabilities in your routers. CEO Vincent Steckler told reporters that weak router security and firmware are the culprits, and you should just throw away the old tech that's not being patched and get something new. Since TV sets, audio systems, coffee machines, and more are vulnerable and tend to not take too many security measures, when someone exploits your router, you open the door to scaring the bejesus out of you with the appliances. At a recent trade show, Avast researchers were able to exploit a router's firmware, change it, and then take control of a TV set, forcing it to play the content they wanted. Even if you turn the TV off, they could turn it back on and make you watch whatever they wanted. So that, you know, that trick that you saw in the Batman movies with Joker broadcasting himself to everyone's TV, it's not just some security theater anymore. It's reality. So welcome to the reality. And folks, that does it to the blip for the blips. But before we move on to the bites, we have an amazing supporter of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and Padre wants to tell you about it.
We'll get back to the action in just a bit, but first we want to take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Drobo is a company that's been around a while from a good idea. You see, it started way back when its founder suffered a hard drive crash and he lost everything. And of course, we all live in fear of that. We all know that anxiety of having our data disappear. And he wanted to create a solution that would make that a thing of the past. He thought his RAID array had him covered, but unfortunately his backup drive failed and it took everything with it. He decided that he never wanted someone else to suffer a data failure like that. And so he sought out a way to create a better, redundant storage solution Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Drobo invented Beyond RAID, which lets you easily add capacity to a live storage array while mirroring existing data. That lets you increase capacity, add a drive, or replace a drive with a larger one without all the rigmarole that you would normally have to go through with resyncing an entire array. Drobo has a battery-backed cache to prevent write failure or data corruption in a power outage. Now, some people know this pain as well. If your NAS is in the middle of writing its data to the array when it loses power, it can corrupt not just that file, not just that sector, but the entire thing. That doesn't happen on a Drobo. Drobos are simple to use. You can add or swap drives without the use of any tools, and you can use the easy-to-read status lights to let you know when you're running out of space. They've also just introduced the brand new Drobo 5N2, which is the next era of simplified network-attached storage for your connected home or small office. The 5N2 provides high performance with an upgraded processor and port bonding capability via 2 gigabit Ethernet ports. It also features something that I really enjoy, SSD compatibility, an mSATA accelerator bay, secure backup, remote data access and sharing, plus disaster recovery for additional peace of mind. All these things were added so that, you just feel a little bit better about where your data lives. The Drobo 5N2 also includes Drobo apps, which include apps like Drobo Pix for photo backup and Plex for media streaming, as well as cloud apps for backup and data syncing. Now, for those who are in it for a bit more power, they've also got developer tools for programs and websites. There's also a full LAMP stack and Node.js, along with WordPress for web developers. App developers can also use C, Go, Perl, Python, or Ruby, and there's even a Git client. Now, folks, Leo Laporte has used Drobo forever, ever since the days of the cottage. I think if he can trust Drobo, so can you. Visit drobostore.com to learn more and to check out their complete line of products. Drobo has recently lowered prices on their almost entire line, and Twit listeners can save an extra 10% off the purchase of select Drobo models, including the 5N2, at drobostore.com by using the code TWIT10. That's drobostore.com, and use the code TWIT10. And we thank Drobo for the support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get back to the action.
Thanks, Padre. So before we get into the bites, we have a bite just a little bit about the influence of the political influence on France due to some hacks, as well as we're talking a little bit about some anti-competitive movements. So this first one's actually pretty interesting. You all heard about the political motivated attack weeks ago in France, where WikiLeaks essentially produced a dump of data on the candidates. It seems to me that this is almost like a de facto standard that's coming up, where they're essentially exfiltration of mass amounts of information via leaks, and then essentially it's mixed with false information, and it potentially takes months and weeks, if not years, for people to sift through it and pull out what's really real, and essentially altering government stances as well as even shifting elections. So in this particular standard, Michael S. Rogers of the NSA saw the attack unfolding. They saw an intelligence traffic as well as pointing to the initial election. And when NSA actually contacted France, France was like, yep, we have it. We can take care of it. And how did they know? Well, they knew that it was being attacked because they used context clues like high-quality phishing attacks and other campaigns that are actually happening with inside their network. And by that time, they knew that it was already too late in the election. So they moved to producing a different campaign in order to flip it on the hackers. And by doing that, essentially they released information that was misinformation and mixed it with the real stuff. So essentially making it hard for when they actually produce the documents at WikiLeaks for people to actually know what's real and what's not. So this is an interesting tactic. It could have essentially backfired on them. But the interesting thing is this is becoming the de facto standard of just essentially any type of election happens. These governments are going to have to understand that potentially hackers are going to come in and try to influence it. So what do you think, Qbert? Is this just something that we just have to be ready for going forward and we just have to essentially have campaigns of our own?
You know, I've been ranting about how, you know, things are changing, you know, the internet's changing the world in both positive and negative ways. We talked to Wayne Rash back in episode 215 about how the internet has been changed. The way you portray information, the way you portray your candidate, the way you talk about it, you know, both, you know, the news items and so forth. We've got a lot of floods of fake news. We've got a lot of misleading news. It's basically propaganda that the candidates are using both as, you know, it's weaponized information. How's that? Weaponized information. And it has definitely changed the way elections are running. You know, right now they're at the national level. But we're starting to see things like this happening at the local level. Before it was banks and banks, you know, a boiler room operation of people calling and trying to get people to vote in one direction or another. Well, that took a lot of time and money and effort. But the world's changing. It's now easy to do spams. You know, setting up a email blast is easy and fairly cheap. It's hard. You know, people, you know, it's gotten to the point where Facebook's even got this, oh, we're trying to identify fake news. Yeah, good luck, guys. It's weaponized information, and we're going to see it as part of every election going forward. And I don't like that. You know, not really.
Yeah, I think the problem here is you're going to have an issue where, you know, essentially if governments are going to put their own campaigns out because they know they're going to be hacked, then you really just don't know what's real and what's fake. And again, you're back to the old science of trying to figure out what that is and data mining and trying to figure out what's actually real and fake, and you don't know. So there could actually be some reality to some of this stuff that's coming out. You know, some of the things that the government actually in France actually leaked. It's pretty ridiculous stuff. But again, you know, people thought it was real. And, you know, when they said, hey, this is just fake information that we leaked, don't believe it because you really don't know what's real and what's fake. They're just kind of adding in there that sense of insecurity and reliability. And so I think that's a big problem. I think, you know, they did flip it on everyone and said, hey, we're going to do the same thing that hackers do to us because hackers, you know, release information, they mix in fake, and then, you know, essentially they tell everybody it's real. Well, in this case, they released information, and then they mixed in fake, and they said everything's fake. So, again, you're not really knowing what's real and what's fake. It could tend to lean, it could actually, you know, almost backfire elections. So I guess that's the question is, you know, what do you think is the best course of action to protect ourselves from something like this?
I think we need max headroom. We need an internet champion that'll go through and, you know, no, seriously, I don't know. This is a really tough one to do because we, you know, there's an old joke. How do you know a politician is lying? Their lips are moving. Well, now we can't see their lips moving because it's all on the internet. I think we're just going to have to develop thick skin and hope for the best. It is in the general public's best interest to be well informed. The days of sticking your head in the sand, I'm sorry, are over. You're going to have to pull your head out of the sand. You're going to have to keep abreast of what's going on. And only through knowledge are you going to be able to have a chance at knowing what's fake and what's not. But good luck.
I think Emily the Strange in the chat room has a good point. I mean, she points out is this any different than just politicians lying? And I think it has a slight difference. I think I feel that some of the data that's leaked is much deeper down areas that we would have never thought would have come out. And, you know, these documents and this information is coming out and made to be true. And I think, you know, it's almost a shock value, like kind of when you see a sticker shock value of something, it's almost a sticker shock value causing you to almost alter your perception of a candidate. So, again, I agree. I think, you know, although there might be campaigns against us, there's smear campaigns against particular political advocates, but you still have to somehow filter it out and, you know, get through it. And I think going forward, it's going to be much more difficult to do that with some of these campaigns coming out. And in fact, you know, some of these leaks, you know, they don't necessarily sift through the information and say, oh, this is all correct. They just kind of dump it out there and let people kind of do what they will with it. So, you know, the media is going to do what they will for it. And so is the public. So I think at this point, we really have no idea what we're going to do. And I think going forward, it's going to be much more difficult. So this one's a little bit more interesting, and it actually throws up some information and some thought about anti-competitive nature. So just recently, Comcast and Charter said that they would be moving into a new venture together. And they both decided that together, that it would be in their best interest if they didn't compete. I don't know about you, Cheaper, but I think that we as consumers should have some kind of a say in it. What do you think? I think, you know, to quote them, and this is kind of interesting, I went and looked at their statement that that they actually put out, and they said, "We want to explore the potential opportunities for operational cooperation and their respective wireless businesses to accelerate and enhance each company's ability to participate in the national wireless marketplace." So although this is a lot of words, let's talk about what this actually means. So this actually means that Charter could essentially go and license something, let's say, whether it be from T-Mobile or Verizon or somebody, and build out their mobile network and resell it to their customers. But before they do that, they're going to go and essentially have to ask for permission from areas. Like, for instance, if they wanted to go into a small market that has internet, wireless internet, or any internet of any kind that Comcast ran, they would have to actually go and talk to Comcast about it. Essentially, if they wanted to acquire a company, maybe something smaller that essentially is in that in the Comcast territory, they would have to go and ask for permission from Comcast first. This doesn't sound like it's going to hurt any consumers in any way. The attorney and senior VP of Consumer Advocacy Group, Public Knowledge, Harold Feld, thoughts are that one of the basic ideas of antitrust law is that when companies compete with each other, or would compete with other people, make an explicit agreement not to compete with each other, that violates the antitrust laws. Well, Comcast has responded and said it doesn't actually violate antitrust laws. So I personally think this is almost reeks of very anti-competitive goals. So what do you think, Jibert? Is this something that we should be worried about as consumers?
I personally like competition. Competition means eventually, you know, hopefully I pay less money for the same services. I was involved a long, long, long time ago on the Coalition for Competitive Telecommunications, where we broke the Hawaiian telephone monopoly in Hawaii for intra-LATA communications, meaning inter-island and so forth. It was actually more expensive for us to call the neighbor islands than it was for us to call the mainland. We managed to break that a year before the federal regulations. Afterwards, many, many years later, I was actually playing golf with the ex-head of Hawaiian Telephone, and he said, you know, that was actually the best thing that ever happened to them. It created so many new markets that they're posting record profits. And this is from the man that barred me from the Hawaiian Telephone building for, I don't know, about a year or two. So competition is good, and having two large corporations agreeing not to compete stifles innovation, you know, like Emily Strange is saying. It's good and it's bad. You know, obviously, if there are higher profits, the company is going to be more willing to throw money in and, you know, create new products. But I like competition. I personally think competition creates a environment of new thinking, new things, how to get one up on your competitors. So my personal opinion, I don't like this. I want competition. I want choice.
Yeah, I agree. I think that this is a tough one because, you know, when these large corporations that are almost monopolies in areas that they're in already, and they come in and they go into agreement with each other, it's almost like they're subsidiaries of each other, and they create this anti-competitive nature agreement that, you know, consumers sometimes will essentially have an issue with. And, you know, I think I have an interesting question for you. What do you think? What do you think that Tom Wheeler would have said about this one, Cheaper?
I think Tom Wheeler would have had conniptions. Tom Wheeler's my hero, man.
Yeah, I think I have one issue with the fact that there's been no voice of this at all coming from anywhere, not from, you know, anywhere from the SEC or anybody talking about this. And it's just interesting to see that, you know, this year alone with all the changes, corporations have no problem with coming out with some these types of statements. I mean, not only do they come out with these types of statements, they spin it as if consumers are going to be okay with it. As consumers are going to love it. It's going to be great for consumers. And I think that this is dangerous because now we're at this point in the timeline where, you know, these companies can do this. They spin it in their own way. And there's kind of nobody in their way or nothing in their way for them to do that. And it could create some, you know, pricing issues and cost issues and, you know, adoption issues for especially areas that don't necessarily have network and wireless, because you might not have really good internet in some areas, and so that's where these kind of wireless companies can come in and produce internet and other services. And you know, and this is basically saying, well, you know, unless my buddy over here Comcast is going to allow me to do it, we're just not going to let you do it. So yeah. You know, again, this is a real tough one, and I don't know. I think it's one of those things that we're going to have to see how it plays out. I mean, do you foresee legislation stepping in here at all?
I don't know. This is the Trump administration we're talking about. You know, I am basically saying the era of the corporate oligarchy is here. We've seen science fiction writers talk about it. We saw it on Blade Runner. We saw it in Max. You know, we're seeing it everywhere of what the world could potentially become when choice is removed from us. I think this is a slippery slope, and I'm not sure what's going to happen when we have so few choices being removed. You know, the Stasi, you know, in East Berlin were always saying, this is your only choice and you will like it. And I'm hearing these echoes throughout the Trump administration.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I think we've pretty much put that one to bed. So, folks, when we come back, we have Tim Titus, CTO of Pass Solutions, and my favorite part of the show. But before we get there, we want to hear from our amazing, amazing supporters. And Padre wants to tell you about it.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is literally, literally brought to you by Sonic. It's our 10-gig fiber provider, the one who transports all our bits. Now, Sonic understands one truth, and that is that the internet infrastructure in the United States is failing. It's a mess. And it's a mess because too many companies don't pay attention to the things that are important. There are too many people paying too much for unsatisfactory cable. Sonic delivers fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Now, their mission is to bring internet freedom to all with unlimited and uncapped internet. That means that they deliver residential and business fiber to the premise networks with gigabit connectivity in San Francisco, the North Bay, and the East Bay. Their internet service plan includes 15 email accounts and 1 gigabyte of storage, personal web hosting with a new domain, and fax service. They even include a home phone connection with unlimited local and long-distance calling. For only $40 a month, Sonic offers download speeds of up to 1,000 megabits per second. Imagine that. For less than half of what some of the other providers are offering for much slower, much less consistent speed, you can get Sonic. Now, on a personal note, I have always been impressed by Sonic's long-standing commitment to support customer privacy. Their record shames other ISPs because they don't treat privacy as an option. It's not a value add or a tactic to get you to buy their service. Their privacy, their service, and their support is baked into their DNA. It's part of who they are. By standing up for privacy, friendly and local customer support, uncapped bandwidth, and affordable pricing for all products, Sonic's customer advocacy is paving the way for a better state of the internet in America. Folks, we want you to join the internet revolution. Visit sonic.com/twit and receive your first month of Sonic internet and phone service for free. Plus, bundle with Dish and save $120 off your Sonic bill. Just visit sonic.com/twit. That's sonic.com/twit. And we thank Sonic for the support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks, Padre. Well, now it's my favorite part of the show, where we essentially bring in an expert and they drop their amazing knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And this time, it's no exception. We have Mr. Tim Titus, CTO of Pass Solutions. Thank you so much for coming, Tim.
Sure. Thanks, Lou. Thanks, Brian.
So, Tim, tell us a little bit about PaaS Solutions. I think, you know, we've heard about it. We talked about it before in previous episodes. We know, you know, that this is amazing, great tool set. What you know, tell us a little bit about what PaaS Solutions and their products.
Well, I got to go back and talk a little bit about my history. Is I've been a network engineer for short of 30 years now. And one of the things I always found frustrating was troubleshooting, trying to find out what glitched in the network. Usually you have a user that says, gee, 20 minutes ago, I had a problem. I had a poor quality phone call. I had a glitch. I had some issue. And they want to know what's going on. And I would look at these people and say, I don't have a clue. And I don't have information to help solve that problem. And I thought about it and said, well, what information do you want to know? Is you want to know where were packets lost? Where were packets delayed? Where were packets routed? What happened to that conversation that caused it to be bad? And I just figured that there needed to be something to solve that problem. And that's where I decided to say, okay, nobody's out there solving this problem of where are these packets going? What's causing them to be delayed or dropped? And that's where I decided to found the company. So it's really, it comes from a need of being able to answer that question of what happened 20 minutes ago to solve that problem. Was really the genesis of creating the solution.
Right. So I saw your presentation a while back, and I totally agree with this. It's something that we even do in software, and it's interesting, you know, having a specific methodology behind, you know, solving a problem in the right way, so that you essentially, you know, by using the right tools and the right processes, can kind of get you there faster. And then it sounds like that's something what PaaS Solutions allows you to do. You tell us a little bit about, you know, that methodology and your beliefs there.
Yeah. So one of the things I've learned in troubleshooting, and I got to say, most of my recent career has all been about troubleshooting, is that when you get stuck, and I'm willing to bet everybody out there gets stuck, they look and they say, I just don't know where to go. I don't know what the next thing is to check. I just don't know how to get this problem resolved. And what happens then is the problem happens again, and the user gets upset, and the problem happens again, and the user complains to their boss, and the problem happens again, and now your CIO is starting to breathe down your neck saying, okay, your job is in jeopardy. Why haven't you gotten this solved? It's been 6 months. This should have been solved the first time it happened. And so these problems end up escalating. The reason that you get stuck is that you don't have enough information in front of you. Effectively, you don't have enough clues. You look at Sherlock Holmes and say, when he was stuck, he went out to collect more clues. And so it's collecting additional clues is really the whole trick to troubleshooting and knowing what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that we have a problem internally here as well. I think we have a lot of data kind of coming in sometimes, and you know, sometimes the engineers will just, you know, add, you know, systems and extra, you know, telemetry based instrumentation to their system, and then the data kind of flows in as a sieve, and it just keeps coming in and in. You just don't really know what to do with it and how to use it, and you know, and how to use it to essentially produce output from it. And that's kind of an interesting take. Is some of the tools that PaaS solution builds, it actually makes use of that data. And I think a lot of these companies that are coming out, these unicorn companies especially, are producing special tool sets that make use of big data and or data from your systems in order to help organizations make the right decisions. So can we tell a little bit about what what your tools do and how they kind of take us there?
So a lot of organizations end up having monitoring software. And they'll say, gee, I've got this monitoring software. It tells me about outages. It makes sure the links are up. Devices are reachable. The problem with monitoring software is it's focused on monitoring the state of the environment. Just make sure everything is operationally reachable. The problem with this is that you could have packet loss all over the place and still not be aware of it. So let's jump to the next slide. Troubleshooting software is focused on trying to find out how did packets make it through the network, and where and why were they lost or delayed? What caused them to not reach their destination? The biggest differentiation between monitoring software and troubleshooting software is that you could have monitoring software say your network is healthy, and yet you could be dropping these packets due to a bad cable or an MTU limitation or even a half duplex connection and not be aware of it. And so that's why you tend to need troubleshooting software in addition to monitoring software. So let's continue on to the next slide and really look at how do you resolve the root causes of problems. So what our software does is it deploys on a single server inside the environment. This can be a virtual machine, shared server, desktop, or even laptop, so it doesn't need big iron to run. Our download is 7 megabytes, so it's very compact, very efficient, yet very powerful. If you jump to the next one, what it will do is it shows that we collect information from every switch, every router, and the entire infrastructure. Doesn't make any difference what make or model or manufacturer, we're going to use SNMP read-only community strings to collect this information in a highly automated fashion. You don't have to download MIBs. You don't have to put OIDs in. It's just going to automatically determine, oh, you have an Extreme switch. You have a Foundry switch. You have a 3COM, old 3COM switch. Or you have the latest Cisco Nexus gear. We're going to be able to pull information off of those devices in an automated fashion. If you continue on to the next one, what we'll show is we're going to collect information off of every link in the entire infrastructure. That way you get complete coverage. So let's jump to the next slide. What we have thus as a result is total network visibility. You're going to get coverage of the entire infrastructure, and you're going to have continuous visibility. What this means is if somebody comes up to you and says they had a problem happen 2 hours earlier, you're going to have all of this information. 18 error counters deep at every 5-minute point on every one of those link switches and routers means you're going to know about any dropped or buffered or queuing issue that happened in that infrastructure. Now, if you jump to the next step, what we do with that information is important. We take those error counters and put them through a heuristics engine that analyzes them to produce plain English prescriptions of the fault. The result is you get plain English answers saying we can find cabling problems, half duplex, duplex mismatch, VLAN tagging issues, jumbo frame misconfigurations, MTU limitations, any sort of layer 1, layer 2, or layer 3 issue anywhere in the network, any point in time, now has a plain English prescription. So let's take the next slide and take a quick look at what this can be done with this. So let's say you had a problem at noon between extension 41 and extension 53. You're solving a VoIP problem, but this could very well be a data problem, a video conferencing problem, any traversal of the network. Typically, to find this problem, you'd have to do a lot of research. You're going to log into all the switches, log into all the routers, check interfaces, check error counters, and you might not even find the problem if it's transient. So what we do is, go ahead and jump into the next one, we're going to automatically map the network and show you every link, switch, and router used between any two IP addresses. You don't need to do anything here. We're going to automatically determine this. Then, if you go to the next one, we're going to show you the health, performance, and status of every element used along that path at all points in time so that you can quickly see what happened earlier in the day. That way, you don't even have to be there to catch it in the act. You can come back in and say, that problem that happened at noon happened because we were dropping 8% out of the high priority queue on this WAN router, and a few minutes later, we were dropping 12% of the packets due to carrier sense errors on this WAN Ethernet router. So you get root cause answers as to what happened at various different points in time and all of the information needed to troubleshoot. So if we want to take a quick look at this, can you switch over to my demo screen? So the solution deploys really rapidly. Within 12 minutes, we're going to scan the network. We're going to find all the switches, routers, gateways, and that entire infrastructure, and immediately start collecting error counters. In a very short period of time, we're going to start finding problems. Now, here we found there's a red dot in front of the Pino switch. I got to admit, I'm kind of a wine freak, so I got a whole bunch of different wines as our switch names and router names. But I'm going to click into the Pino switch. We can now see all of the interfaces on that switch. We have a red dot in front of Fast Ethernet 0/2 and 15% packet loss. Usually the first thing people think about is, well, great, that's fine, but what's plugged in there? Because if this is a printer, nobody cares about that. The printer will just retransmit the packets. On the other hand, if this is a server or a VoIP phone or a critical gateway or a trunk port, that's important. That's critical to have fixed. To that end, we have all of the CDP and LLDP information, and we also have a fully integrated port mapper, so we can tell you what's connected there.
Tim, sorry, real quick. What's the significance of the 12 minutes when you talk about, hey, all happens in 12 minutes, you get the total visibility? What's the significance behind that? Is just the way how long it takes to collect all that data?
Yeah, well, one thing I was frustrated with in my work as an operations manager is solutions that were complex and took a lot of information in and digested information, typically you'd have to set up a database, set up a web server, spend 6 months configuring it to work with your network and have a lot of customization and professional services. And I looked at that and said, nobody wants that. They want something that deploys and says, day one, this is starting to earn its payback. That way you can start solving problems right now. So it's that there's a high degree of automation so that this is not something that takes months to actually get some benefit from. You can get benefit by minute 13.
That's great. Great.
So we can see on this interface that there's only one MAC address connected, and it's associated with VLAN 82. We can see the manufacturer of the device here. We can also see the IP address, and we can get a reverse DNS lookup telling us the friendly name of the device. Now that we know what this device is, I can click into the interface. I can see the utilization over the past day. I can see packet loss over the past day. And down here at the bottom, we have a plain English prescription of what the problem is. That way, we can immediately move to resolve the problem. No additional troubleshooting. Now, some people might wonder, how the heck do you identify a cabling fault? Well, if you knew all the error counters, it would tell the story. I'm going to click on View Advanced Stats and scroll down, and it's going to show us all 18 of the error counters that we're analyzing. What we do is we have a heuristics engine that expertly analyzes this to say, when you have FCS errors and you have no alignment errors and no collisions, you're typically fighting a cabling problem.
I got to point out that it does use SNMP, CDP, LLP, but the cool thing is everybody thinks, oh, SNMP is so simple, but there's actually an amazing richness to MIB1, well, MIB2 especially, and you can do an amazing amount with that information. For a lot of people that have been working in the field, I like to call this a Fluke One Touch on every single port in my network. And being able to get all these error counters in perspective is just amazing.
And one thing to add to that, Brian, is if these error counters weren't important, the manufacturers would not have made the effort to build it into every one of their devices. So since they see it as important, they want you to know about this stuff. It's just trying to manually configure something to go after it or diving into the CLI and traipsing around trying to find these error counters just means it's a painful process every time troubleshooting happens. And we figured, let's get this out in front of people so they can get the problems resolved. Okay, so with this amount of depth, let's put this all together. If we could zoom back out, I can show you how we do a path map and put this all together to do a root cause troubleshoot. So if I go to the path tab and say we had a user that had a problem between this PC and this server, put in the IP address of the PC, IP address of the server. And again, this doesn't have to be a PC to a server. This can be a phone to a phone, phone to a gateway, video conference unit to video conference unit. You click map. What it's going to do is look at every link, every switch, every router used to connect those two devices. So here's the PC. Looks like it's plugged into the Pino switch, connected to fast Ethernet 0/15. Over the past 24 hours, this connection looks perfectly healthy. That means that the problem is not happening here. And perfectly healthy means perfectly healthy according to all 18 of those error counters. Outbound, it's going out through fast Ethernet 0/7, also perfectly healthy. Looks like inbound and outbound on the Denver router looks perfectly healthy. Outbound, though, on the New York router, we have this sporadic 1% packet loss. If we look at it from current, 2 hours earlier, it was dropping 3% of the packets. So since that's when that user complained about poor quality service between those two IP addresses, and this interface was involved in that transit, I'd say this is definitely suspicious. Go over, click into the interface, read that plain English prescription, and get the problem resolved. Now, I want to stress that you just get this one problem solved, you shouldn't stop troubleshooting because there might be other problems involved along the way. We get to the Bordeaux switch. Oops, sorry, scrolled past it. And inbound at the same time, another 1% packet loss. And that interface is running half duplex. Something we can also do, if you have MPLS in your environment, you can get a read-only community string from your MPLS provider for the on-prem routers. This means the router that your carrier provides that's sitting on your in your office, we can be able to make sure that the inbound Ethernet interface is healthy, they didn't under-provision the router by sending you a router that's peaking at CPU, but you can also see the QoS configured on the outbound interface. So you can look and say, gee, this carrier's configured class-based QoS with a high-priority voice queue and a default queue. Now, any VoIP engineer is going to look at this and say, this is bad news because the high-priority voice queue has no usage. all of the voice tag packets are dropping into the default queue. That's bad. We can easily see why if we click into the interface and scroll down to the queue and say, here's that queue and the match condition. Now, in this case, the match should be looking for DSCP EF, which is what VoIP typically uses. And what we can do is we can call up the carrier and say, hey, guys, thanks for setting up that high priority voice queue, but you fat-fingered the configuration on setting up the match condition for the DSCP tag. Can you change that to EF? And they make the change, and you're going to start seeing some utilization hit this queue. So this is how we do a root cause troubleshoot between any two IP addresses, 18 error counters deep on every involved link, switch, and router so that nothing is outside of your viewpoint. That way, you get problems resolved quickly.
So Tim, one question for you is how long do you keep the data? Is it something that, you know, you produce this issue, you find an issue, you go in and you investigate it, you use the really fancy heuristics that are in there that tell you, get any insights into issues. And like you said, sometimes, you know, if you don't dig deeper to potentially find issues and they kind of go long lasting, how long does the system actually keep data as historically wise?
So you're going to go back effectively 13 months worth of information. 12 months figuring you want to be able to compare January of this year to January of last year. So it's 13 months worth of rolling history going back so that you can always see what happened and see if there's trends that are happening. Does this happen every Tuesday at 1 p.m.? Does this happen every first of the month? That sort of thing. The database is SQLite, so it's compiled into the application. There's no separate database server that you have to set up, no licensing. No trimming and truncating you have to do. So it's a maintenance-free type of solution that just does its job.
So one thing I find interesting, there's so much data there and so much good information. I almost find, like, do you find it yourself actually just kind of monitoring it throughout the day just to see if you see issues even though you don't have any?
Well, what's actually better than that is you can do that if you want to stare at a screen and say, gee, did something happen? But we're also going to send alerts. But I guess more importantly than that even, what we send out is a daily network weather report. What this report is, it's a morning email that when you go through your emails in the morning, it's one email that says, here is the state and health of your network. That way you start your day aware that, okay, your network's healthy, you can move on with other things. Or you start your day saying, whoa, hey, that's a lot of packet loss on that server connection. Let me address that before somebody opens a ticket and complains about it so you can be proactive.
So I actually use TotalView, and I use it on my the Aloha Cabled Observatory, and just to keep all the principal investigators quiet, I actually have them on the email list for the daily weather report. Interestingly enough, I can be buried, and as long as everything's good and there's no loss, it's all green and says zero, my PIs leave me alone. But every once in a blue moon, I have this one particular switch under 3 miles of water that loses its mind. It should never have gone down. There's no way to fix it at this moment, other than I have to go and restart it and reload the firmware. Not a big deal, but it's a kind of a pain. But I'd never know when it's going to happen. So all I need to do is first thing when I wake up in the morning, I read my email. I see my weather report. I see a 2.3% loss, and my weather report goes red. It's like, okay, first thing when I get in, I need to reload that switch. It has saved me an amazing amount of problems, and even oceanographers can tell instantly that something needs looking at.
And I'm just going to sum that up and say knowledge is power. By you knowing what's going on and you being ahead of the game, you can be proactive rather than reactive, which is really – that's, I think, what every network and system administrator dreams of, is being ahead of the user, never having to tell the user, I wasn't aware of that, let me work on it, but being able to tell the user, I know about it and the problem's solved, it's not going to happen again.
So Tim, you and I met back in the mid-90s working on the InteropNet together, and yep, we've seen all kinds of things happening. Now, one of your favorite bragging things that you like doing is how fast that TotalView installs and how easy it is to go and start mapping. Why don't you talk about InteropNet, you know, what it was like working on a Class A network, And maybe tell us a little bit about what happened at Interop this last week.
Sure. So I'm going to actually admit to a little bit more. So I met Brian when he was terminating a piece of fiber on the show floor. This was for one of the PEDs. I fear that the word PED is going to be retired because there's no show network anymore, which is a very sad thing. And I'm going to be doing everything I can do to say they need to bring back an Interop show network. You were terminating a piece of fiber, and I said, teach me. You know, I had to watch you while you were doing this because I figured there was just something that I've never seen done. I usually buy cables, but seeing it done and seeing the polishing and seeing the cleaning mechanism, you were talking at the very beginning about how much cleaning is necessary. You know, that's where Interop started for me, but it started, you know, I think a decade before that even. This year, what happened at the show is really kind of two things. Is one is there was no show network, and I was kind of bummed by that, by the fact that it was a showcase that showed off how vendors interacted with each other, and that absence, I feel, was noted. Something else that happened, which was, I think, a first time for Interop this year, is there was a major power failure on the show floor. The entire conference facility basically lost power for about 15 minutes, and it was completely dark. There were only one or two vendors that had anything generating any amount of light, and those were the UPS vendors that were there, which showed them in good context. But it was kind of amazing to see that happen and figure you're in such a large room that is so dark with so many people. It got a little eerie pretty quick.
So one thing, the interesting thing, Tim, is a question from the chat room is, you know, as these device manufacturers tend to change their topologies and some of the other firmwares, and they continue to update, you know, do you have to continue to update the solution that you have? And do you support things like, for instance, like one of the questions was, do you support SMP version 3 encryption?
Yeah. So we do support SNMP V1, V2C, V3, all of those capabilities. As far as the device manufacturers, I think really what that person's asked is they've really asked the question that really exposes what our secret sauce is here. Our secret sauce is the ability to feel out a device and say, what are you capable of doing? What MIBS do you support? What information do you have? And so if we end up talking to a device and we discover, aha, you're a Cisco device. Okay, I'm willing to bet you probably have this support for these MIBS. And we end up talking to the device and we find out, no, it doesn't support these MIBS, but it supports these other MIBS. So that feel-out process allows us to determine, okay, this is a Cisco, it's a Nexus, it's a Nexus 7K, it has support for these features and capabilities. That's the information we want to expose. So it's really our whole trick here is eliminating going to download MIB files for certain OS versions for certain devices, bring back the data from the device in an automated fashion, and make it so that the information is normalized and useful to people.
So, Brian, you have some thoughts on why this is good for video and VoIP systems.
Yeah, so I've been up on a soapbox. In fact, I've actually been in Tim's booth, you know, talking about how I use TotalView on the Aloha Cabled Observatory. The thing that really and truly got me interested about TotalView is the VoIP and streaming video. There's an awful lot of people out there. I've actually been talking to some big audiovisual integrators, and more of audio, more and more video is all going digital. And the problem is a lot of these people are dropping it on to dumb networks with no quality of service, no nothing. And they're wondering, they're scratching their head going, oh, what's, you know, why isn't it working? So what I'm going to toss to Tim about is, hey, Tim, if I'm starting out as a, you know, I'm starting to do VoIP and video and so forth, what are the things we really need to take a look at? And also, for the integrators out there, they're probably asking, just how is this licensed? You know, is it by ports? Is it by servers? You know, so two questions there. How does it fit into the new world, and how does it priced?
Okay, so let me go into the technical first. If you could share my screen again. So there's two parts to running a network that is perfectly ready for voice, video, and data. The first part is you want to eliminate problems. So if you install the product, have it scan through the network, and find all of the issues, you can work through this issues list and say, let's get rid of all this packet loss. Let's eliminate these interfaces that are having bandwidth limitations, get rid of subnet masks that don't match, incorrect ARP cache entries. So fix everything that's in the network. The second part of it then is you want to validate this network. So to be able to do that, we actually have a license unlimited call simulator. And so this call simulator allows us to send synthetic voice traffic anywhere in the environment with an unlimited number of agents. So let's say you're doing testing for a company that has 10 remote sites, or if the company has 200 remote sites, doesn't make a difference because our call simulator, you can run as many copies as you need. Another thing about the call simulator, though, is that you can use it to simulate synthetic voice traffic to any location you want. You don't need to set up a remote agent. We have a patent-pending technology that sends out a stream of ping packets to a destination. We then encapsulate those ping packets into a G711 codec or whatever codec, and I'll show you all the codecs we have momentarily, but it will then properly DSCP tag those packets. Now, I'm doing a quick test here across my LAN. So this is from my PC to my default router. I can verify very quickly that my LAN is a healthy environment because I have no loss of DSCP. I have no out-of-order packets. And by the way, out-of-order is critical to make sure you don't have in a voice or video environment because the codec must discard out-of-order packets. Not a lot of other solutions test for that. We're also tracking your latency, your jitter, your packet loss, and providing a MOS score. Now we can load the network up and see how many calls we can do, but in a LAN environment, we can do a ton of calls, so there's no need to do that. But if I want to do a test across my WAN circuit, I can quickly put in the IP address of the router at the far end of the WAN circuit and see what call quality looks like to that location. So you can test to any location you want very quickly. You can also load the network up if you want to see if it can handle 7 simultaneous phone calls and see if the network degrades. In this case, we're seeing latency jump up into the red zone, packet loss jump up into the red zone, so we can't do 7 simultaneous calls across this link. So this call simulator, again, you can run as many instances of it as you need. You can use it for work-at-home users, remote offices, and you don't have to set up the remote agent. And we have all of the codecs supported. And one thing I want to point out, we're the only company right now that supports all of the Skype for Business codecs, including Silk, Siren, real-time audio, real-time video. So we're a little bit ahead of the others in that area, but also the flexibility of just having this be license unlimited gives you a ton of ability to say, let's test calls anywhere we want. So Tim, this gives you both sides of the picture. What is the network doing, and then how is the network responding?
I think it's important to kind of get that holistic view of your area and just kind of understand how things are flowing throughout time and over time. So these are some really cool tool sets. But unfortunately, Tim, we've actually run out of time. And I wanted to thank you so much for being here on the show. And so can you tell the folks a little bit about where they can find you and all of your work?
Right. So www.pathsolutions.com. I did want to answer your second question really quickly, is that we have a number of different licensing models. We have a perpetual, if you want to buy it and use it for your own network, there's a licensing model for that. Ends up being quite inexpensive for a lot of organizations. We also have a licensing model for resellers. So if they want to end up going out and troubleshoot their own customer networks, we have a tech expert license for that so that you can put it on your laptop, go out and troubleshoot problems at any customer network. So a lot of flexible licensing options depending upon what your usage model is.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tim, for being here. And it's great information, and we appreciate you being on the show.
Thanks, Lou. Thanks, Brian.
Before we end, actually, Brian, we've had some little bit of information coming down the pipe, right? Some new information from VMware?
Yes. Our friends at VMware have finally gotten to the point where they're giving me emerging technology. And this one's kind of interesting. It's a press release, so I apologize. I'll throw it into the chat room. But it's interesting in that VMware and Google are announcing a partnership or a cooperative agreement for working together. Now, and I should say this is Google Chrome OS. And basically what it is, you know, everybody was interested in VDI, but a lot of people got chased away because of pricing. Chrome OS with VDI is a match made in heaven. So anyway, very quickly, thin clients aren't dead. It looks like it's going to be a Chrome OS thin client world.
Sounds great. Thanks, Brian. Well, folks, you've done it again, and you've used up another hour of listening to pretty much the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 network nodes. Thank you to everyone that makes this show possible, especially to you, our loyal listener. But I couldn't do this show without my co-host, Mr. Branchy. Mr. Branchy, where can you find where can they find you and what you've been up to?
Well, I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, on Twitter. And you know what? I'm finishing up some Wi-Fi tools stories for InfoWorld. And depending on what happens, I might actually be doing a DNS appliance shootout. It seems the shootout world isn't dead yet. And I'm just waiting on final approval from the executive editor.
Amazing. Always find it interesting, all the stuff you're working on. So thank you very much, everyone. Especially thank you to you, our loyal listeners, the person who's watching. It's the reason why we can bring this show to you week after week. And we want to make it really easy for you to find the show and listen to the show. So go head over right now to twit.tv/twiet. All of our episodes, links, notes. Even there's a little drop-down menu there in the corner. You can subscribe to the show on your favorite service and even choose the device of your choice. So essentially, head it over there. And of course, we also do the show live every week on Friday at 1:30 Pacific time at live.twit.tv. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, we might as well come into the chat room as well. We have an open chat room at irc.twit.tv. And we listen, we get questions. In fact, sometimes we even kind of veer the show in particular directions based off of everyone's comments and questions. So come on over and head over and do that. We also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially thanks to Leo and Lisa for allowing us to do this show week after week. And also thank you to our super producer, Mr. Brian Chiebert. He does all the legwork to kind of getting these shows put together. And of course, thank you to our loyal and helpful engineer, Kevin. Kevin, what's going on over there? Can you tell us a little bit about what you do at Twit and what kind of shows you work on?
I hold down the fort when everyone's at Google I/O.
Is there tumbleweeds right now hanging?
Yeah, there's tumbleweeds.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for everybody for the show. And I'm Louis Maresca. And if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.